get it meet.
You have how many children?
I don't want to say precisely because that risk. So my children have had to move, in one case change the name that they were using, the same with my mother, etc. So that's a result of the security situation. And then there's also there's an issue as to whether I can be pressured in certain ways as a result of my family. So can people pressure you? So that produces a situation where it is quite difficult to see your family if they're trying to be undercover and there is surveillance all around the embassy and there's press all around the embassy.
You entered the embassy when you were 40 years old. On July 3rd, just a few days ago, you celebrated your 43rd birthday, your third birthday inside the embassy. Where will you be for your next birthday?
That's a good question. I could still be here. I think the developments are such that if you look at kind of the direction of the direction of how the politics is going, the U.S. primaries will start in about a year's time. The Obama administration starting to consider what its legacy is going to be in the Liberal Democrat area of things. There's an election next year here in the United Kingdom. There's an election in September in Sweden, which will take the country from centre-right to centre-left. May not improve things much in the same way that going from, I'm not sure what you call the Obama administration, but going from Democrat to Democrat, if Hillary gets in, it may not change things very much in the United States. But this political trajectory, I think, is creating a situation where we can more effectively use the law. You know, that there's not so much pressure on courts to find one way, not so much pressure on the court system. And so I think it's getting to a stage where it's able to act in a more neutral manner.
If the Swedish government guaranteed that you would not be extradited to the United States, would you agree to go to Sweden for questioning?
That's what we've been asking for 4 years now, but it's not just me that's been asking for it. The Ecuadorian government, as a state that has obligations to protect someone that they've formally granted asylum, has asked the UK, can you guarantee Mr. Assange will not be extradited to the United States? And has also asked Sweden, can you guarantee Mr. Assange will not be extradited to the United States? Not for anything, not a blanket guarantee, but in relation to our publications. And both governments have said no, that they refuse to do that.
Julian Assange, thanks so much for agreeing to this interview.
You're most welcome, Amy. Thanks.
WikiLeaks founder and editor Julian Assange. I interviewed him inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London this past weekend. To see the first hour of our TV radio global exclusive, go to democracynow.org. Special thanks to Mike Burke, John Hamilton, and Dennis Moynihan. I'll be speaking in Hartford, Connecticut, July 21st at the Mark Twain House and Museum at 7 p.m. And on July 26th in Martha's Vineyard, check democracynow.org for details. A fond farewell to our treasured fellows, Tarina Nadura and Cassandra Lazare. We wish you the very best for your oh-so-promising futures. Democracy Now! Is hiring. We have openings for administrative director and fall internships. Check our website. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltzer, Amate, Nermin Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Hani Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Gesder, Amy Littlefield, Messiah Rhodes. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, Portland 91.9 FM, Hood River in the Gorge 104.3 FM, Philomath and Corvallis. Up next, your KBOO evening news.
KBOO wants you. Yes, you. Are you excited about the new possibilities for local independent media? Are you ready to help KBOO reach out and grow stronger in the community? We're looking for candidates for KBOO's Board of Directors, and we've extended our search through July 31st. So if you'd like to share your skills with the people who share your values, download a copy of our Board Candidate Package at kboo.fm. Or you can pick up a copy at the station during business hours. We're located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Applications must be received by 5 p.m. July 31st, so don't delay. and we look forward to seeing more of you at KBOO.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the second annual Debtors Assembly Portland on Saturday, July 12th from 3 to 6 p.m. at Holiday Park, located at Northeast 11th and Holiday near the Lloyd Center MAX stop. Hosted by Strike Debt Portland, the Debtors Assembly will be a public gathering of neighbors and community leaders, seeing debt in a new way, one of social justice. Experts will speak on how the debt industries work and how they enable poverty and wealth inequality. And finally, organizers will lead group conversation on building creative ideas for local collective resistance against unjust debts. Again, at Saturday, July 12th at 3 p.m. in Holiday Park. More information may be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, local activists claim victory as the city of Portland agrees to end discrimination against formerly incarcerated job applicants.
The CEO of Portland tech startup Urban Airship steps down amid accusations of sexual assault.
And information on trains carrying volatile crude oil in Oregon is posted online.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 9th, 2014. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Frances Fagan. Israel is continuing its attack on the Gaza Strip, hitting the region with rockets aimed at some 200 targets today. Israel is also said to be informing military reservists of the order to deploy, signaling the possible ground invasion of the Gaza Strip. 22 people reportedly died in the Gaza Strip today, bringing the current body count to 49, while Palestinian militants fired over 70 rockets into southern Israel. Violence between Israel and occupied Palestine escalated last week, following the discovery of the bodies of three kidnapped Israeli teens in the West Bank. We'll have more on the conflict in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center later in this broadcast.
A campaign by local and national activists to get the city of Portland to end discrimination against job applicants with a criminal history has succeeded. The city announced today that it has removed language from its employment applications that requires applicants to list their criminal history. The city joins more than 60 U.S. jurisdictions, including Multnomah County, in removing the barrier to employment for formerly incarcerated people. The nationwide campaign to remove these types of barriers is commonly called Ban the Box, which refers to the questions on employment applications that ask whether the applicant has been convicted of a crime or has been incarcerated. KBOO's Karen James spoke with David at Sisters of the Road Cafe several months ago about the impact of the criminal history checkbox on job applications for people who were formerly incarcerated.
Tell me about yourself.
Well, I've just a normal, average person trying to do what everybody else is doing, look for a job to support his family and maintain a good, stable life. As far as job-wise, I've noticed that, yeah, that box is a big problem. I honestly think that that box just needs to go away because all it's doing is just causing a lot of chaos and it's causing a lot of depression.
And what box are you talking about?
The one that you have to check if you've been convicted of a felony or not. Considering the fact that whenever you check it, a lot of companies will sit there and say that they do not discriminate against felons when in reality they actually do, and it makes it a lot harder for, you know, people that have actually done their time and, you know, have moved on, don't want to go back to the same lifestyle anymore, but when they go to try to look for a job and they have to check that box, they get a little bit, you know, nervous, they don't know if they're going to get discriminated against or if the job's going to sit there and say, well, you have a felon, get out of our business.
And how has that affected you job-wise?
I mean, it's affected me in a real big way because it's really hard for me to look for a job right now. And every time I have to check that box, I get really scared because, like I said, I don't know if the company's going to discriminate against me just on account of that I have my felonies.
Do you feel that companies have discriminated against you?
Well, there's a place that's in Tennessee that I filled out an application for. It's staff partners, and when I filled out the application, I had to check, yes, that I was convicted of a felony. And they looked at that, and they're like, well, we were going to hire you, but since how you got felonies, you have to go.
And do you have any other experience?
Fast food restaurants, manufacturing corporations, just in general. I mean, there's been times where I've had to literally do side jobs just to make enough and me just to support my family. And I've got a couple of kids and everything, and with me not having a job is making it really hard on me, and it depresses me.
So what do you do for income?
Right now I'm out flying a sign, doing whatever I can to make any type of money I can get my hands on. Because every dime that I make is all going towards my daughter. I have to do what I got to do just to actually buy my daughter's Christmas presents this year. And I'm not used to that. I'm used to actually having a full-time job, being able to sit there and pay my rent, pay my bills, pay all my utilities and everything like that. And like I said, it's depressing. A lot of homeless guys out here that are trying to look for work, it's not just me, but I noticed that a lot of them are in the same boat, considering the fact that they're trying to look for jobs and they get the same treatment. It hurts me to have to see that, because there's a lot of good workers out here that are felons, but yet society does not see that. Society only sees, well, these guys are going to end up going back to the same thing they did in the past, which is probably ripping the company off or anything like that, and a lot of guys don't do that. As far as I can see, you know, I wish a lot of companies would, yeah, get rid of that box, because it would make the economy a lot more better. It would actually provide a lot more jobs. And there would actually be probably a 50% decrease in homelessness if they got rid of that box.
That was David, who is one of thousands of Oregonians who have been discriminated against on employment applications for having a criminal record. The new policy announced today by the city of Portland will remove the box requiring a criminal history statement. Questions about criminal background, if relevant to a position, would still be asked later in the hiring process. Mayor Hales said the new policy removes a barrier to employment with the city, which will attract a more diverse pool of applicants to city jobs. He said that stable employment significantly reduces the rate of people returning to prison, helps to build stability, and breaks the cycle of incarceration for people trying to get back on their feet.
A county judge heard arguments today about the extent of Multnomah County's gun ordinances and will decide if and to what extent they can be enforced. The city of Troutdale passed an emergency ordinance last night saying that it does not believe that Multnomah County gun restrictions should be enforced in the city. Residents in Gresham and Fairview filed suit against the county in response to the ordinance in June, saying the county had no right to enforce the ordinance in its 8 incorporated cities. In 2012, Multnomah County Commissioner passed bans on carrying most loaded guns in the county, although concealed carry rights were left untouched. The ordinance also made it a crime to allow a child access to a firearm that was kept in unlocked storage. The ordinances, according to then-Commissioner Deborah Cafori, were inspired by the 2012 shootings at Clackamas Town Center and the killing of 26 people at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut. Since then, a gun owner, Joseph Powell, became the first person charged under the ordinance after he was arrested near Reynolds High School on the day when 15-year-old student Jared Padgett shot 14-year-old Emilio Hoffman last month. Powell said he was armed in order to protect his sister, a student at the school.
Picketers stood outside of Emanuel Hospital on Wednesday morning in protest for fair wages to provide better jobs with living wages. KBOO's Jamie Partridge was at the rally during the protest.
This is Jamie Partridge with KBOO News out here in front of Emanuel Hospital, where there's an informational picket line staffed by, I'd say, about 50 workers in purple shirts saying SEIU Local 49, and their picket line is carrying signs that say SEIU negotiate now, honk for fair wages, Legacy can do better, CNAs, that's certified nursing assistants deserve respect. Patients before profits. Don't hate, negotiate. The flyer says that this is an informational picket in support of good jobs and quality care here at Legacy Emmanuel Hospital on North Vancouver Avenue. It's just not fair. I don't know, but I've been told Emmanuel has a pot of gold. So we're talking with Caitlin Doherty, who's an executive board member of the Service Employees Local 49 and on the negotiating team here at Emmanuel Hospital. And what kind of work do you do here at Emmanuel?
I'm a central sterile technician. I've been there for 17 years.
So what's going on at the bargaining table?
Well, Emmanuel Legacy executives have decided that they're going to offer us 1.5% a year for 3 years, and that's not acceptable. It won't pay the rent. It won't pay the increases that people have to deal with on a daily basis in their lives, and we're not going to stand for it.
So wages are an issue. Are there other issues?
Safe staffing, better jobs, security for our seniority. Absolutely.
And how is the community here that's served by Emmanuel? How are they affected by this struggle?
When we're not able to have enough staff to sufficiently care for our patients, it is a factor because we have people that are doing too much overtime. They're not. We just don't have enough staff to properly care and for the patients and do the best job that we're able to that they deserve.
And so you've got a picket line out here, an informational picket.
Yes.
That you're going to be running all afternoon here on
11:30 to 4:30.
Here on Wednesday afternoon, and is there a possibility of a strike in this conflict?
We're hoping to avoid that. We're hoping that when we go back to the table on the 22nd, that the board members are willing to listen and maybe hopefully come to a fair and equitable solution. So we're hoping to avoid a strike.
And what can members of the community who are supportive of the workers here at Legacy Emmanuel, what can they do to help out?
They can call Dr. Morgan's office. They can call Dr. Brown's office. They can call HR and demand that their employees receive fair wages, safe staffing, and job security. Absolutely.
So Dr. Morgan, who is Dr. Morgan?
Dr. Morgan is our chief administrator for Legacy Emmanuel Medical Center.
And what's her phone number?
Her phone number is 503-413-2958.
And what do you want people to tell Dr. Morgan?
We would like to tell Dr. Morgan that it's time to work with Emmanuel caregivers to ensure safe staffing, quality care, and good jobs at Emmanuel.
All right. Thank you very much.
Caitlin Doherty.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jamie Partridge, KBOO News.
Out that trains containing volatile Balkan crude oil take around the state on its website. The records detail the activities of four train routes operated by the railroads, the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, Portland and Western, and Union Pacific through the state. Railroads are required by federal law to disclose the routes of trains carrying 1 million or more gallons of oil from the Bakken oil shale region. Bakken oil was found by federal regulators in January to be more volatile than crude oil originating elsewhere, leading to an official warning. Bakken oil caught fire and exploded in Montreal, Canada last year when a train carrying it derailed, killing 49 people. Records detailing the routes of the oil trains, the companies which own and ship the oil, and where it originated were initially obtained by the state last week. Oregon officials had previously tried to prevent information on the location of oil trains in the state of Oregon from being made public. The state of Washington, on the other hand, has posted the same information without withholding details. Here's a clip of Dave Thompson with the Oregon Department of Transportation. Speaking with KBOO's Jenka Soderbergh back in April, he denied the information on oil trains should be tracked or made public by the department.
Our obligation is to make sure that we inspect and monitor the trains so that we know that the track is safe, that the trains are put together in the right order, that the valves are closed, that the signals are working, that the crossings are functioning to save people's lives so that they know that a train is coming. So we are the inspectors for the infrastructure. Particular issues about what the train is carrying don't normally come to the transportation department. There are some requirements about hazardous material movements. Trains carrying those hazardous material movements, that the information cannot be released while the train is moving. That's in state law, so we will follow that. But we will certainly give the information we have to anybody who wants it.
Are there other state agencies that collect this information from the railroads?
I honestly don't know. I understand that some information would certainly be turned over to the emergency response agencies up and down the lines that would need that to be able to respond. And I am going to presume that agencies such as the Office of Emergency Management would have some information. But to be fully honest, you'd have to check with them.
After that conversation with the Department of Transportation, I called the Office of Emergency Management for the state of Oregon and spoke with Corey Grogan. I asked him about what the ODOT spokesman told me, that the Office of Emergency Management should be the agency that has information on how much fuel is transported through the state and where it's located.
That's not our agency's responsibility. What I can tell you is that there's ODOT inspectors, and they regularly monitor the train speeds, track conditions, train car placement, stuff like that, and they serve as an audit, so they are monitoring, you know, some of the trains that come through. I can't speak on everything for ODOT because it's not my agency, but I can tell you that that's not one of our agency's responsibilities.
But as far as tracking the actual transport of hazardous materials through the state, that's not something that's done through your agency?
No, that would be the Federal Railroad Administration. They're in charge of monitoring the transport.
I called the Federal Railroad Administration and was told that that agency also does not have information on where and when fuel is being transported around our state. They wouldn't go on record and told me to call the Surface Transportation Board, which didn't return calls for comment before this broadcast. The location of fuel transports in Oregon is important for emergency responders who need to know where hazardous materials are located in case there's a spill. But according to Corey Grogan of the Office of Emergency Management, the agency has no way of knowing that information until a spill actually takes place.
The important thing to note here is that if that does happen, we're going to be activated. The State Office of Emergency Management, we're going to open up our Emergency Coordination Center, and that's going to be open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, as long as it's needed. And we're going to be the central reporting point, and we're going to help kind of coordinate all that information and just provide the continuity of operations that's needed to respond.
And when you would be trying to assess the amount of oil that had been spilled, if such a thing were to happen, who would you go to for information as to what was on the train, for example, how many cars, how much oil was on that train? Who would you find that information from?
Well, we would be working with a variety of agencies at that point, including, ODOT, DEQ, the Oregon State Fire Marshal, Federal Railroad Administration, the railroad itself. Basically, that's, we're serving as that hub to take in all that information. We'd be coordinating with all those agencies to get all that information in one place for that continuity I was talking about.
That was KBOO's Jenka Soderbergh speaking with Dave Thompson of the Oregon Department of Transportation. 2 months after KBOO's conversation with state officials, the Oregon State Fire Marshal has announced that the information will be made public, but with a number of redactions.
The Portland Public School Board met Tuesday evening to discuss the direction of standardized testing in public schools known as the Common Core. The board appeared to have consensus on a resolution that would call for Oregon to delay using the new tests in school and teacher ratings. Board member Ruth Adkins, who helped take the lead on crafting a resolution, said the board needed to put out a message that showed the district doesn't support teaching to a test, but education of the whole child. Bobby Reagan of the Oregon Board Association gave a brief description of what Common Core is.
The National School Boards Association Center for Public Education put out a publication called Understanding the Common Core Standards. And the reason that I wanted to kind of do this extra framing, if it's possible, is they say that the public remains mostly unaware of the new standards or how they will affect schooling in their communities. And so I just wanted to take a moment to just kind of give a little bit more background on what Common Core standards even are. The Common Core state standards are academic benchmarks intended to define the knowledge and skills that high school graduates will need to be successful in college and careers. The standards have been endorsed by a whole variety of organizations, including National PTA and both of the National Teacher Unions. The Common Core standards establish grade level expectations, specifically in math and English language arts. So we're not talking about the broad spectrum, but it's in those two areas, so it's a little bit more specific there. Internationally benchmark, so that all students are prepared to succeed in our global economy and society. The Common Core is not a curriculum. It's a set of standards that describes the knowledge and skills students are expected to develop. It doesn't prescribe how to teach them, and I think that's a really, really important thing. As a parent, I certainly know that I hugely appreciate the creativity of teachers in our classroom, so we obviously want to maintain that.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News.
Stephen Buell, a school board member, opposes using Common Core as a main source to determine the accuracy of how a student learns.
This is a complicated issue. I mean, I've read hundreds of articles on this, and I've talked to hundreds of teachers, probably, about the Common Core. And it's not necessarily that the Common Core is this evil thing. It's really the reverse. It's just not necessarily that the Common Core is this great thing. You know, there's some good things in the Common Core. We need to look and see if there's some good things in there, and we need to add them in if there are, into what we're doing. If we did that, I'd shut up and say, let's quit it right now. But that's not how it works in schools. In schools, it's, we're going to push the Common Core. I talked to a teacher who, in this school system, he was in a little bit of trouble for his teaching. And so the assistant principal was in his room 36 times during the year, always pushing on Common Core, Common Core, Common Core, Common Core. Now, I'm telling you, doing good Common Core isn't going to make you a better teacher, really. That's not how it works. But that's how we, as a district, seem to be approaching it often. And it's not that we're any different than anybody else in the country. Everybody else in the country approaches it this way. We should be testing whether our children can do foundational skills in mathematics, and we should be testing writing. And then beyond that, we should not be really testing anything. We should be teaching children science and social studies and PE and so forth. And the idea, and what's happened, everybody in education practically goes overboard, where, yes, literacy is incredibly important, but to do literacy in PE, which is if you, and I can find you ones, I could go find literacy things in PE, what's the point of that? We should be doing science in science, social studies in social studies, and guess what? Children will learn to read. We should be focusing on getting kids to read. So we're spending millions of dollars on testing children in this state, and we can't even get librarians into our schools, which are proven to read. No one has proven that this helps one child.
A vote on the Common Core resolution by the Portland Public School Board will be on July 22nd.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with Yana Maksimova and Don Merrill about KBOO's investigative work looking at the influence of the American Legislative Exchange Council in Oregon, followed by Right to Survive Radio at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is partly cloudy with a high of 85. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 30 counts per minute in North Portland, 27 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 34 CPM. Hanford, Washington has a count of 31 CPM. And North Vancouver, British Columbia has a current radiation count of 33 counts per minute. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. Radcast alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, in 1868, the 14th Amendment is ratified, granting African Americans full citizenship and due process. Also in today's history, in 2011, the country of South Sudan was granted independence.
It is 5:30, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
How would you react if one of your neighbors announced that while he obviously benefits from having clean water, highways, Medicare, police protection, parks, schools, and other public services, he was no longer going to pay his part of the taxes that make them available? And what if this neighbor also said he was renouncing his American citizenship to become a citizen of Switzerland because he could pay less in taxes there? Not that he was actually going to move to that cold country, mind you. No, no. He'd still be living right here in the good old USA, still benefiting from all those public services that taxpayers like you provide. Surely you think this has to be a joke. Well, meet Gregory Watson of Long Grove, Illinois, who has announced all of the above. While he's not personally your neighbor, the corporation he heads might be, for it has stores in hundreds of neighborhoods all across the country. Watson is CEO of Walgreens, the $72 billion a year drugstore chain that is America's largest. But Greg no longer wants Walgreens to be American, so he's planning to reincorporate it in Switzerland. Why? To skirt paying about $800 million a year in corporate taxes that Walgreens owes to America. Of course, the stores will not move to Switzerland. Watson fully intends to keep extracting profits from our neighborhoods and for Walgreens to keep benefiting from all the public services that America provides, from police to infrastructure. Oh, and one more thing. About a fourth of Walgreens' annual income is derived from, guess who? The U.S. government. Yes, the very government that Watson and company say they no longer want to help support. The unpatriotic drugstore ingrate drew nearly $17 billion last year from Medicare and Medicaid payments provided by Uncle Sam. This is Jim Hightower saying, if Walgreens doesn't want to support public programs like these, the programs should not be supporting Walgreens.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The CEO of Portland's tech startup, Urban Airship, has stepped down following allegations of sexual assault that were made public yesterday. Scott Gvetten announced an extended leave of absence after a former girlfriend's accusations that he had raped her multiple times were published in the Oregonian last week. The woman reported four incidents over a three-year period to police in North Plains, Beaverton, and Portland. No charges have been brought against Gvetten, who maintained that their sexual contact was consensual. An investigation by the Portland police over incidents in 2011 and 2012 is still ongoing. Gvetten co-founded Urban Airship in 2009. The company became a resounding success for its pioneering work in delivering enhanced push notifications for applications on mobile devices. Urban Airship has received $46 million in funding from companies such as August Capital, Intel, and Verizon, and employs 150 people in Portland.
President Obama announced today that he will crack down on children crossing the border from Mexico. The president's announcement came after a meeting with extreme right-wing Texas Governor Rick Perry.
How is this different from other information that we've heard about NSA surveillance?
Well, so for a year, we've had stories that basically documented the NSA's technological capabilities, as one might expect, given that the leaker, Edward Snowden, was somebody who was a contractor working on, you know, presumably developing tools that the NSA would use for surveillance. So the most, you know, kind of spectacular headlines were, you know, things about how the NSA had direct access to the servers of Google and Apple and things like that, that the, you know, that they had every phone number, you know, that was called by somebody who was anybody who was a Verizon subscriber and so forth. But all these things were very general. It didn't talk about, you know, who the NSA was looking at. It just talked about their capacities and what they were trying to do, which was basically collect everything, right? But in terms of, you know, what they were actually sort of, you know, looking for, you know, where they were directing their the attention of intelligence agents, we didn't really have a very clear idea of that. In fact, I would have guessed, you know, a week ago, if you'd asked me, that Edward Snowden didn't really have access to any of that information about, you know, who specifically was being targeted for scrutiny, right? And it turns out over the weekend, the Washington Post was the first to report on Sunday that, that in fact, Snowden did have a huge archive of targeting information. And we see now the first real substantive story about this in Glenn Greenwald's story that went up at midnight last night that shows that, you know, five very prominent Muslim American, you know, figures, you know, a professor, a political candidate, two lawyers, and in fact the head of the Council on American Islamic Relations, you know, a major sort of civil society, you know, community group basically, that they were subject to surveillance under FISA by the NSA and FBI. So, you know, this is really sort of an astonishing kind of revelation, not only for what it is, in that it shows that the government was going after people who, you know, came out and said to Greenwald that they had nothing to hide, people who've been slandered a lot by right-wingers in the media and have withstood all of those attacks, that they were targeting those people, you know, basically, you know, most likely because of their political beliefs and because of the fact that they were Muslims.
Your group has put out a statement that there is a comparison to be made here with the targeting of Muslim leaders with the civil rights era, in which people like Medgar Evers and Martin Luther King Jr. were spied upon by the FBI for their political activity.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So, you know, CARE is, you know, again, a leading Muslim American kind of political organization that has, you know, been out there in front fighting for, you know, the civil rights of Muslim Americans in the wake of 9/11, right? We think that's a perfect analogy to Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Ella Baker and all the other leaders of the civil rights movement who were targeted for surveillance, basically based on manufactured suspicions that they were associated with the Communist Party back in the 50s and 60s, right? You know, the opponents of the civil rights movement always tried to tar those folks with the idea that they were somehow closet communists, right? So now what you have instead is, you know, that there are these, you know, unproven claims that, you know, CARE and some of the other individuals who are mentioned in the story have tangential associations with Hamas or other foreign political parties that the U.S. government has, you know, labeled as terrorist organizations. And so, you know, before it was, you know, you were closet communist, now it's your closet terrorist organization sympathizers, right? You know, in fact, if what these folks are saying is true, that they have nothing to hide, then this is instead a case of the government targeting an organization for its lawful political activity and basically conflating support for Palestinians and equal treatment for Muslims in the U.S. With the sort of suspicious activity that, you know, that could justify surveillance of actual terrorists.
And ironically, this is coming out just a week after the case was finally dropped against Samuel Aryan in Florida, who was targeted, as you said, the way the government has suspected people of some sort of connection with Hamas. Originally, that was the case against him after 11 years, a number of which he spent in prison. The government has finally dropped the case against Samuel Aryan. I've been speaking with Shaina Kadidal. He is with the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of a coalition of 45 organizations that today published a response to the revelations that came out last night that the NSA has been specifically targeting Muslim leaders in the U.S. The coalition is calling for President Obama to provide a full public accounting of surveillance practices of American Muslim leaders. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
The current wave of anti-immigrant media began with an article published in early June on Breitbart.com, a conservative news and opinion website founded in 2007 by the late Andrew Breitbart. He was responsible for creating doctored videos that brought down Acorn, the nation's largest African-American-led organization for the poor and the working class. The reporter that filed the story on Breitbart.com, Brandon Darby, is an FBI agent who has spent years infiltrating anarchist protest and relief groups. Darby was involved in Common Ground Relief, which helped thousands of people in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina in 2005. He then filed briefs with the FBI to try to target people in that group that he said that he had befriended. In 2008, Darby pressured two young activists to make Molotov cocktails at the Republican National Convention in Minneapolis. Although the explosives were never used, the two teens faced long jail sentences for making them. Brandon Darby published the pictures of children in immigration facilities that have been used to push for the deportation policy announced by Obama today. The president's unilateral action has been seen by analysts as an effort to appease the far right.
Muslim and Arab Americans have long suspected the government targeted them with racial profiling techniques following the attacks of 2001. New NSA documents released today by reporter Glenn Greenwald have proven these suspicions to be well-founded. The newly released documents show that the agency has racially profiled Arabs and Muslims, with a specific focus on Muslim and Arab leaders who were outspoken on the issue of profiling. The Council on American Islamic Relations, the nation's largest Muslim civil liberties organization, today joined with a broad-based coalition of 45 organizations to challenge the practice. The groups are calling on President Obama to provide a full public accounting of surveillance practices of American Muslim leaders. KBOO's Janka Soderberg spoke with Shana Katadel, a senior attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, about the newly released documents.
So the bottom line is actually that there's nothing that the governor indicated he'd like to see that I have a philosophical objection to. I've asked Jay Johnson to contact his head of Health and Human Services when he comes down for the sixth time at the end of this week to coordinate and make sure that some of the suggestions that the governor has are technically feasible and what kind of resources might be needed. But what I emphasized to the governor was the problem here is not a major disagreement around the actions that could be helpful in dealing with the problem. The challenge is Congress prepared to act to put the resources in place to get this done?
Former New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin has been sentenced to 10 years in prison on corruption charges. Nagin was convicted in February of bribery and money laundering, among other charges. He was accused of accepting hundreds of thousands of dollars in bribes from businesses looking for city contracts. Prosecutors had sought 20 years for Nagin, but the federal judge who handed down the sentence cited his genuine but all too infrequent desire to help New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina in 2005 showed good character. She also said that Nagin's cuts of the illegal contracts show that profit was not his main motive. Nagin was a vocal critic of the federal response to the hurricane, which flooded much of the city and killed 1,800 people. He became a household name nationally when he passionately asked for help for the city's residents in a radio interview following the storm. Nagin will most likely serve his sentence at the low-security federal prison in Oakdale, Louisiana.
And now, the latest news and developments from occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, July 9th, 2014. Death toll in Gaza reaches 39 killed and 300 injured as Israel escalates its attacks and targets residents' homes. Meanwhile, 12 youth are injured in the West Bank clashes with Israeli soldiers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. At least 15 Palestinians were killed on Wednesday as Israeli aerial bombardment continued to target the Gaza Strip since the early hours of this morning. According to local sources, among those killed there were 5 children. Israeli attacks were reported all over Gaza City, Rafah, Khan Yunis and Beit Hanun. Medical sources said that 300 people have been admitted to hospitals for treatment after being injured due to the Israeli attacks. IMEMC's in Gaza, Rami Al-Mighari, says Israel is targeting residents' homes at random.
Israel has picked up attacks against the homes, the residential homes of the Gaza Strip. This is really a sort of a dangerous development of the situation since the very beginning of the Israeli attacks on the region. A home has been struck by Israeli airplanes in the town where I live, actually. 5 people, including a woman and a child, those two killed. For their hospitals in Gaza, as many staff have been lacking, sort of medicines have been lacking as well. There is a shortage of the medical supplies, and that has been warned by the hospital officials and the health officials in the territory.
The death toll have now reached 39 killed. On Tuesday, Israeli attacks targeting the Gaza Strip left 24 Palestinians dead due to the Israeli bombardment. From their part, Palestinian resistance fighters in Gaza continued to fire homemade shells into different Israeli areas. Armored groups vowed to continue the firing of shells in retaliation to the ongoing Israeli attacks targeting the Palestinian people. Elsewhere, at least 12 people were injured. Many others were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation as Israeli soldiers invaded West Bank communities and clashed with local youth. Clashes were reported in the central West Bank city of Ramallah and Bethlehem city in southern West Bank. Moreover, a Palestinian teen was injured when Israeli settlers attacked him on Wednesday morning in East Jerusalem, local sources reported. After being beaten up and injured, Israeli troops forced the teen to leave Jerusalem and refused to file charges against the attackers. The youth is from the village of Yatta in the southern West Bank, local sources added. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, July 9th, 2014, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Shmawi and me, Ghassan Badnoura.
In Iraq, a mass grave containing the bodies of more than 50 people was discovered in Hala, a city south of Baghdad. The grave was discovered in fields outside the city. According to local media, the victims had their hands bound, were blindfolded, and were shot in the head. The sect of the victims is so far unknown. The discovery of the graves comes as Iraq is dealing with militant Sunni extremists who have taken over cities and energy infrastructure in northern and western sections of the country. Sectarian killings have also been a continuing problem. A civil war, which took place during the U.S. occupation of Iraq, killed tens of thousands nationwide, and attacks last year claimed the lives of nearly 8,000 civilians, the country's highest toll in 5 years. Estimates of the number of Iraqis killed since the 2003 invasion by U.S. forces are anywhere from 150,000, as reported by Iraq Body Count, to a study last year by American, Canadian, and Iraqi universities, which put the death toll at 500,000. A survey by Opinion Research Business in 2007 put the death toll over 1 million.
In the latest news from U.S. occupied Afghanistan, a suicide bomber killed 16 people, including school children, in the Parwan province of eastern Afghanistan. The bomber struck as international soldiers were handing out school supplies to a group of children. 4 Czech soldiers were also among the dead. In other news, Afghan presidential hopeful Abdullah Abdullah continues to dispute his defeat in the country's elections, citing what he says is fraud. Abdullah's supporters gathered at a town meeting in Kabul, where some threatened to form their own government. And a United Nations report says 5,000 Afghan civilians were killed in the first 6 months of 2014, up 25% from the same period last year. It marks the largest civilian death toll in a 6-month period since the UN began keeping records in 2009. The deaths come largely from crossfire and on-the-ground fighting as battles between insurgents and the Afghan military have moved into unfortified towns and villages.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sequina Wright and Jamie Partridge. The producer is Mike Klepfer. Our engineer is Ian Westmoreland. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you would like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard about on the news tonight, here are their phone numbers, so grab something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor John Kitzhaber's number is 503-378-3111. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, on K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Frances Fagan. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With journalists Amy Goodwin and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Joanne Hardesty hosts Voices from the Edge, progressive talk radio from a grassroots perspective. At 9 on Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell asks, why can't the U.S. help child refugees? And other questions on the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, host Leanne Kranz welcomes local author Polly Dugan to talk about her debut short story collection, So Much a Part of You. At 11:30, on Words and Pictures, features stand-up economist Yoram Bauman, who's co-authored the new book, The Cartoon Introduction to Climate Change, and will join Gus Frederick of the Home Davenport Project, on the Homer Davenport Project, on a tour of Oregon cartoon history and a preview of an upcoming political art show in Silverton. Thank you for listening to KBOO Community Radio, and thanks KBOO members for supporting us. If you are not yet a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
And now it is time for News from the Boo, our weekly program where we hear from Monica Beamer and Mike Crenshaw, KBOO's station co-managers, about the happenings inside of and around KBOO. Tonight we'll be speaking with Monica, as Mike is not here due to a death in his family. Monica and I will also be interviewing Don Merrill, KBOO's lead investigative reporter, on the American Legislative Exchange Council project. The phone lines will be open if you'd like to call in with a question or a comment. Once again, the number to call is 503-231-8187. That is 503-231-8187. Monica, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How about you?
Not too bad at all.
Good.
All right, let's launch right into Don, since he's waiting for us and time is short. We are being joined by Don Merrill, investigative reporter working on KBOO's ALEC project. Thank you for joining us for News from the Boo today. Don, are you there?
I am.
Do we have you, Don?
Yes, can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Hey, Don.
Hey, Monica.
Give us, in a nutshell, what is ALEC and what are the goals of this project?
ALEC is an acronym for the American Legislative Exchange Council, and it's a 40-year-old organization that is dedicated to free market, limited government, reduced federal regulations as they support business. And they have about 9 task forces, and each task force focuses on a different aspect of the American economy, whether you're talking about energy, environment, and agriculture, technology and communications, commerce and economic development, tax policy, immigration policy. Alex spans the gamut for what they do to try to make things much easier for business. Unfortunately, what they end up doing is making things much more difficult for the average middle-class worker.
And the environment.
And the environment.
So what are the goals of KBOO's ALEC project?
The goals of the project are to, back in February, Jenka Soderberg, the news director for KBOO, received a grant from the Fund for Investigative Journalism to do a series of stories about how ALEC has influenced the Oregon legislature. And so far, the team has produced three stories. Their most recent story aired on Monday, and it looked at ALEC's influence in privatizing education here in Oregon. The next story is going to be about how ALEC is affecting public employees, and we have a few more stories to do. We'll probably do one on ballot initiatives that are affected by ALEC, and then we'll do an overview of the future of ALEC, because ALEC has had its problems.
What are you finding?
Well, I mean, we're finding that, a lot of the information that we started out with was information that fortunately had been gathered from other sources, such as SourceWatch, PR Watch, ALEC Exposed. There are a lot of organizations out there. Bill Moyers, in fact, Frontline. A lot of organizations have done a lot of background work on ALEC and a lot of groundbreaking journalism on ALEC. What we found is in the Oregon legislature, there are probably about maybe 20 to 22 legislators who are either openly or outed members of ALEC. Most of them tend to be Republican, although there are a few Democrats, and we think there may be more Democrats, but we're not really sure because, of course, Democrats don't necessarily want to be affiliated with a conservative lobbying organization. We've also found that ALEC has spent an awful lot of money. When legislators go to these conferences, ALEC sponsors three conferences annually, a spring conference, a summer conference, and then a conference in the winter. And at each of those conferences, they sort of lay out what they are working on legislatively. And the way it happens is legislators go to these conferences, they rub elbows with people who are captains of industry, because a lot of ALEC's financial support comes from a lot of very well-placed companies like UPS, Yelp, Texas Roadhouse. I mean, just a lot of companies that you would never think of support ALEC. So these legislators go to these ALEC conferences. They are members of a legislative group. They work with a business group, and the task force is associated with those business groups. And then they come back with legislation, and the legislation is then what they introduce into the legislature. And, of course, that legislation is favoring business. What we found is that another thing is that a lot of these businesses contributed an awful lot of money to the campaign committees of some of these legislators. In the story we did on Monday, we discovered that the two leading charter school corporations in Oregon, K-12 and Connections Academy, have since 2011 donated more than $50,000 to a handful of members of the legislature. And so we're just continuing our work, and we're just trying to make more connections, and we're just trying to do good journalism.
Again, we're speaking with Don Merrill, KBOO's lead investigative reporter on the American Legislative Exchange Council project. Don, have you been surprised by anything that you've uncovered so far?
Really, I think the main thing about investigative journalism is that unlike the Pentagon Papers or Woodward and Bernstein, a lot of times investigative journalism isn't about the scoop. It isn't about the smoking gun. It's about finding information in plain sight. The thing about finding that information and following up on conflicts and incongruities is that a lot of this information is really kind of hard to find. And it's not like it's being hidden. It's just that there is so much information that really it comes down to sifting. And that's really what the team has been doing, going through the language with software, reading the language word by word, and comparing the language that ALEC provides to the language that Oregon legislators have submitted. And then that's where we find similarities, and then we find who has been sponsoring that legislation by being able to link one type of legislation to another type of writing. And then we go to the committees and find out, you know, who is being supported by what committee, where are they getting their money from, and then we find out what companies donate to those committees. So it's not like it's a big gotcha moment. It really is a very slow and methodical process.
How can KBOO listeners hear more?
We are the stories that we've already done are already on the KBOO website. We did one story which was an introduction to ALEC. We did a story about GMOs. As I said on Monday, we just did a story about education. All of our stories will be posted on the KBOO website. And if you want to find out more about the American Legislative Exchange Council, you can go first to their website. They do have a website, www.alec.org. You can also go to SourceWatch, PR Watch. You can go to ALEC Exposed, which is a website that was created to investigate ALEC. There are all kinds of sources you can go. In fact, Bill Moyer, Terry Gross, they've done interviews with representatives of ALEC. So there's a lot of information out there.
Great. Well, thank you so much for all of your hard work on this very important KBOO project.
It's a great team. Yana Maximova, Mike Klepfer, Sam Smith, and Sam Bowman, all great reporters.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you, Don. Be sure to check out our website for important community events. They'll be on the right-hand column of the homepage, and you'll get more information about Don's important work on ALEC. Also, spread the word. KBOO is taking applications for its board of directors, and more information is available at kboo.fm. Thank you very much, Monica, and thank you, Don.
Thank you.
And thank you, all you listeners, for joining us for News from the Boo. We will speak with you all again next week.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio proudly present Nightmares on Wax live, playing at the Clinton Street Theater as a benefit for KBOO Thursday, July 10th at 7 p.m. Performance comes from a sold-out show at the Refuge in Portland on Thanksgiving evening 2020.